It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside acclaimed author Dan Robson and Dave Zarum. I'm holding in my hot little hand right now The Crazy Game, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond. I guess it's a biography on Clint Malarchuk.
Yeah, it's a memoir we wrote together. So it's in his words, but it's I wrote it with him over the last year. That's a pretty interesting read, I think.
I think I'm going to mention this book every 20 minutes on this program so people remember that this book exists. But yeah, it's a great, I look very much forward to reading it. How long did it take you to write this thing, Dan?
It took about 3 months last year. Last October, about this time, I was out in Calgary and LA with the Flames. We were traveling, doing this, interviewing every single day and talking about what would be in the book. So it was a long process, and then months and months of editing it, and then HarperCollins put it out just last week, so.
Well, it's like I said, looks like a tremendous book. It's heavy, so that means something, right?
There's lots of words in it. I think there's like 90,000 words in it.
There's no pictures, are there?
Are there pictures? Yeah.
Okay, there are pictures. Never mind.
All right.
Oh yeah, and glossy color pictures.
It's fancy.
Okay, I'll check it out now.
All right. Okay, lots to get to today. Maple Leafs win yesterday, 4-1 in Columbus against a Blue Jackets team that like dressed three guys. Everybody's hurt in Columbus. And the Blue Jackets lose. Their number one goaltender is hurt. Curtis McElhinney took the loss. And now the Maple Leafs kind of going through their injury concerns as well because Joffrey Lupul has suffered his annual injury. It's not his fault. He fell during practice and broke his hand. He's out for who knows how long. Didn't play yesterday. It was surprising news to hear that he was out, that he broke his hand. But the Leafs went into Columbus in a game they should win against a team that I mentioned has nobody. And they won. And they played a Sabres team that they should have beaten, and they did. And they only allowed 10 shots on goal. And there's been moments this year where people have looked at the Leafs, and I've looked at the Leafs, and they've said, man, this team looks like it could be in the Connor McDavid sweepstakes, right? Like, against the Penguins, they looked brutal. Against the Bruins, they looked horrible. And there was talk of effort. Well, here they are through 10 games in the season, and they're 5-4-1. I mean, they're not otherworldly, but they look good at times. Went into Long Island, beat the Islanders, could have won opening game of the season against the Canadiens if not for kind of a smelly goal that Jonathan Bernier allowed in the first shot of the game. So what do we make of the Maple Leafs now, 10 games into the season, Dave?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, you kind of mentioned it. They're beating the teams they're supposed to beat and having a rough time against the teams that maybe we'd expect them to have a rough time against. I don't know where the Islanders necessarily fall at this point in that category, or in that conversation, rather. But so far, I mean, I think tonight, first of all, tonight's going to be interesting against Chicago to see how they do against a team that's playing really well as opposed to, like you mentioned, Columbus or Buffalo. You know, that's the kind of, those are the games that I think are really going to be the measuring stick for this club. They looked good last night against a team that they should have crushed, and they did. I think one thing you got to be really excited about is the way the top line is playing, Kessel, the way they're producing points, because, you know, this team's going to rely on those guys so
much.
He
scores, they win.
Pretty much, yeah, that's how it works.
But he's racked up some points in the games that they've won, but the games that they've lost, he has not registered a point in, which is not great.
And I think that's the formula, for better or worse, that seems to be the formula for this team.
Yeah, I think this is a team that depends on certain parts. I mean, last year you depended on Bernier so much. You depend on your goaltending to just bail you out after you have 34 shots against a game. Kessel right now, I mean, you're right. Every time he scores, they put up wins. But the problem is the rest of that team isn't getting that offensive output. I mean, last night you had a few points from Winnick and things looked a little bit better. But again, they're basically playing against Columbus's minor league team.
What do we make of the minute breakdown yesterday? Because Phil Kessel played alongside Nazem Kadri, but they only played about 13 minutes, and I think we agree any line that Phil Kessel's on is the number one line, quote unquote. But Tyler Bozak played over 20 minutes, and he played on a line with James Van Riemsdyk, who also played just about 20 minutes as well. And it seems pretty clear that Randy Carlisle isn't all that trusting of Nazem Kadri and probably not of Phil Kessel when they're trying to defend a lead, mm-hmm. which kind of makes it, I guess it could be a minutes breakdown that's kind of in flux depending on the game situation, which I guess makes sense. Can you win that way?
I mean, I think we're about to find out. I mean, it does seem like Carlisle wants to kind of use a situational lineup that changes on the fly just based on what's happening on the ice. At the given moment, like you mentioned, defensive, if they need a stop, you know, maybe we're not going to see Kadri. If they need a goal, that's when you play him alongside a guy like Kessel. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, at some point, I think you need consistency and to know, you know, whose job it is and when. And I don't know if we're going to see that in the near future in Toronto, but it remains to be seen. I don't know.
Your phone is massive. Sorry, I can't go any further, Dan. I'm looking at your phone. That is a massive phone.
I think it's bigger than the massive size coffee cup he's got here.
You're getting accused of being a walking commercial for the iPhone 6 yeah. Plus. I love it.
Almost as big as the book, The Crazy Game.
That's good.
Clint Malarchuk, and we're only 8 minutes in. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dan Robson, acclaimed author, and Dave Zarum. Before we go any further, Maple Leafs also announcing, because of Joffrey Lupul's injury, they've called up Sam Carrick and sent down Stuart Percy. So he looks like he's going to be the yo-yo man this season. So Carrick adding a little depth on the forward ranks. So we mentioned Kadri. Kadri's kind of the lightning rod for this team. He's the guy people like to talk about. They like to rip him. They like to get excited when he does things of the offensive nature. And we're all just kind of waiting for him to emerge as this team's number one center, because I think you ask most people, they like Tyler Bozak. He's a fine player, and he can do some things. He can certainly win some faceoffs, which Nazem Kadri isn't all that prone to do. But I think you get more of an offensive flair, more of an offensive upside with Nazem Kadri. I think we can all agree with that. But it just, for whatever reason, in the limited sample size he was given on the top line last year with James Van Riemsdyk and Phil Kessel, it didn't mesh. They didn't really produce all that much. This is a situation now we're looking at a couple of games where the lines have been mixed up, and at least yesterday, so far, so good on the point department.
Yeah, he looked pretty good yesterday, and I mean, Kessel, I mean, the thing is, when you're with Kessel on that team, you're obviously going to look better no matter what.
Yeah.
And that's, it's hard to tell, and I think the big question that, Mark, that we still have about Kadri is what kind of player is he going to be in the end? Where is this guy going to be the top one center that we're looking for?
You know, when I look at Kadri, I kind of get, I don't know if this is a compliment or not, but I kind of get like Sergei Bereson vibes.
Does he smoke as many cigarettes as Sergei Bereson? I don't know.
I can't speak to
in the
that.
Intermissions?
You know what? He just may. But like in the sense that he has these flashes where you're like, oh, this guy's, he's going to be a stud. Let's build the whole team around him. And these little short flashes. Maybe my memory's foggy on Bereson. I don't know. But
it is a Saturday morning, so I mean, yeah, that would make sense.
but then you look at him sometimes, you think, you know, I don't know if I want to put all this responsibility in his hands quite yet. So I don't know. The jury's still out for me on this guy.
It's interesting. Well, first of all, how do you smoke cigarettes and be a professional hockey player? Just ask Sergei Bereson. But impressive
the
stuff.
The long history.
70s and 80s. That's yeah, all you did.
I get it kind of in baseball, but yeah, a cardiovascular game like hockey, it's impressive.
Vladi Divac.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, it'll be an interesting scenario to see how it progresses for Nazem Kadri on that top line with Phil Kessel. And you mentioned, anytime you can play with Phil Kessel, it's a bonus and you're going to get your points. Well, I don't know if that was necessarily the case last year when Kadri played on that top line, and that's maybe why it was so surprising. We all expected the points to be there, a guy who can put the puck in the back of the net, and it didn't really happen. So I guess to me, I was waiting for this indication, and it's, again, we're just talking about one game, and I know it's small sample sizes, but this is all we have to work with here so far. I guess to me that's a good indication that they look pretty good together and had some good chemistry, especially on a 2-on-1 as well.
Yeah, it was a beautiful 2-on-1, but again, that 2-on-1 was entirely Phil Kessel.
Right.
Mean, it was a perfect delay and it was a perfect pass, and it worked out really well. So it worked out well for Kadri. So I mean, you're right. It's unsure. If last year he goes in and he's not putting up with a guy like Kessel, and that's a big problem. And you have to figure out in the future how that's going
to
turn out.
But also, when you saw that 2-on-1, it kind of looked like these two guys were like made to play together. Two guys who can kind of.
But how many times did we say that about James Van Riemsdyk last year, right? Like,
that's right.
James Van Riemsdyk has a career year playing alongside Phil Kessel. I'm sure he's not too pleased to be broken up from that line, although he played more minutes yesterday. But yeah, I mean, not that Phil Kessel made James Van Riemsdyk's career, but sure had a good season last year playing alongside him.
Well, how do you feel about having JVR on the second line?
Well, it's an interesting scenario because clearly Randy Carlyle is more comfortable with that line and giving it defensive responsibility. He loves Tyler Bozak. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loves him. And there's a lot of things to like about Tyler Bozak. The faceoff wins in particular are good. Won 53% of them yesterday. Won 14, lost 12. But he's a responsible defensive player. And I guess that's what you get with that line, more so than the potential for goals with the Phil Kessel and Nazem Kadri line. Plus, you spread out the scoring, don't you, as well?
Yeah.
A guy we haven't talked about as well, who had a nice game yesterday, 500th career game, Daniel Winnick, mm-hmm. scored. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who I don't think many people expected many points out of, and yes, it was his first goal of the season yesterday, but kind of under the radar, played a bunch of minutes for Anaheim last year, good puck possession guy. He didn't start on the top line, but played some minutes with Nazem Kadri and Phil Kessel, which is kind of an interesting scenario. We've got two guys who can put it in the back of the net and one guy that can hold on to the puck. Doesn't seem like a bad little combo.
No, it worked out fine yesterday.
Yeah. So far, so good. And the Maple Leafs now over 500 at 5-4-1. Jonathan Bernier got another start yesterday, picks up the win, makes 28 saves. And I guess is back to being the front runner as this team's number one goalie. But do we really have a problem with kind of like alternating? Because obviously James Reimer is going to get the start tonight on the back end of back-to-backs. That's kind of a no-brainer, even if Jonathan Bernier was back to being the de facto number one. Has James Reimer really done anything to lose his, 1A status? Are we back to where we were last year going into that California road trip where Jonathan Bernier got hurt? Are we that set in Jonathan Bernier being this team's number one goaltender?
I mean, I think the popular conception that's where we are, and I do believe the Leafs want Bernier to turn out to be that guy. But they do have a lot of faith in Reimer, and we should have a lot of faith in James Reimer. I think that, Leafs fans should be happy with the goaltending situation they have right now. To have a guy of the temperament and ability of Reimer in that role, I think the thing is he's able to he just wants to work hard, and he wants to make sure that he takes every opportunity he can to get there. I don't know if there's enough faith that he's the guy the fans can rely on throughout the season. So I think Bernier's definitely got the number one title, and he hasn't lost it yet.
But listen, it's a huge luxury for a team to have two guys they can put out there. I mean, you think, what if Bernier goes down? What if one of these guys goes down? It's so important to have that second guy there. I think that being said, when you had as the season progresses, heading into closer to the playoffs, if the Leafs are in that conversation, I think at that point, that's when you want your number one guy, and it's a matter of who's going to step up. And I think they're going to give Bernier the chance to be that guy.
Yeah, I just think it's definitely, whereas last year it was more of a question, it's anybody's net, and that's a tactic that I think teams take, and it can be effective, but there's a different approach this year. And, off the bat, it kind of looked a little bit questionable. But Bernier is a phenomenal goaltender. He's going to be fine. I think we're talking about the early, early part of the season, and I don't think you can look at a couple iffy games and say, well, is this the right thing? I mean, we can't get too crazy here.
They should trade him.
Well, I think they should trade Reimer and give him a shot somewhere else and see what they can get. But I like to your point, it's good to have two solid guys.
Yeah, you mentioned how early it is in the season. We're just 10 games in, but it's all we have to work with. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Dan Robson. What about the back end on the blue line here? I think people were blown away by what Stuart Percy brought to this team on the back end early in the season. Surprising guy just to make this team and then looked pretty good. He was maybe the Leafs' best defenseman first couple of games into the season. Got a rest there to get Jake Gardner back in. Jake Gardner's the guy on the long-term deal. And you knew he would be back in that lineup. He was sent down previously this season, called back up. Sent back down again today as Sam Carrick comes up. He was a healthy scratch yesterday. So, I mean, it's just a numbers game to me when I look at that back end, because I think Stuart Percy has shown enough. And I know he's a young guy, and at least have a whole bunch of young defensemen. I guess you don't want to have like three pretty young guys in Morgan Riley, Jake Gardner, and Stuart Percy playing at the same time. But you got these older, what you expect to be stalwart defensemen on the back end, and Roman Polak and Stefan Robida, and I don't know if they've really blown anybody away, but you went out and picked them up, so I guess you got to play them, right?
That's the thing, yeah. You paid them, so you got to play them. Whereas with the younger guys, you can set them to the minors feel good that they're going to get their minutes there, get those reps, and then walk away happy.
Right, and I mean, and they're still learning. I mean, we'll look at these guys. We get anxious about, are they going to turn out to be what they want them to be? But you need a mix of veterans and youth on that team. And now we've got that, and the Leafs should be, I think, happy about that.
Overall, though, where is this team? I mean, I think people expected it to be an 8, 9, 10 team in the Eastern Conference when it's all said and done, maybe in the playoffs. I mean, possible. Not in the McDavid sweepstakes. It doesn't look like they're going to be there. But is this team pretty much what we expected? Again, through just 10 games this season, is this team, to you, looking like an 8th, 9th, 10th place team? Or is this a team that could do more, or a team that could be in the McDavid sweepstakes?
I don't know. I mean, I think you see how they do against a team like Chicago tonight. I mean, when they take a real team that's a real contender. I don't know if we can take anything from Columbus and Buffalo and sort of be making evaluations on where this team sits. But no, I do think they're about a 9, a 10 in the end. I think what they are is a few years away. They've got some good prospects down in the minors and in their system. And I think that, unfortunately, as is always the case, they need to be patient, but they're really trying to grow some talent.
This team needs to be positioning themselves to make the playoffs this season, because I think it's pretty clear they're not a Connor McDavid team.
Yeah.
And then, so if you're missing the playoffs, then you're in the worst position of any professional sports team, where you're just out of the playoffs, but you're not getting the top prospects, and you're in no man's land.
But that's the Leafs can survive in no man's land because they have the support.
Yeah,
I mean,
they're going to have,
and if you look at the plan, they've got.
But as far as building your organization, it's not a great place to be.
No.
David Clarkson, we got to give him a shout out as well before we go any further. Had another goal yesterday, his third of the season. His first of last year did not come until a long way into the regular season. He's looked like maybe not the goal scorer supreme that they thought they were getting two off seasons ago, but a valuable contributor. And actually, I mean, not just the three goals, but he actually looks like one of the Maple Leafs' best players out there when he's on the ice.
Well, he's in a good position because, I mean, expectations couldn't have been lower for him after last season, right? I mean, he really disappointed a lot of people, or at least surprised people who expected him to be better. So heading into this season, I mean, he had to be epically bad to kind of be worse than fans perceived him as last year. And so he's playing well, but based on last year's performance, it seems like he's like an all-star suddenly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about how much pressure you felt from that too, though. I mean, coming with this big contract, I mean, that's got to weigh heavy on you when perform, and it's such a disappointment. I mean, it's got to be a great feeling for him too. You know, even with his face mask on.
Well, yeah, is this a Rip Hamilton situation? Does he never take that thing off? Does he have to play with it for the rest of his career now?
It should be team mandated. You can't take that off.
Right.
It worked for Rip.
Yeah.
And Damian Cox thought he broke the story that he was going to play without the face mask yesterday. I guess so he's healthy enough that he doesn't have to play with it, because all indications were he was going to take that thing off for yesterday's game. He didn't. Scored again. Played another great game, and I don't know. It doesn't seem as uncomfortable as that Rip Hamilton thing where your face gets all sweaty and it's like stuck to your face. At least not touching your face.
It's just minor league hockey. It's just like you're 8 again. Like it's
that's right. It's maybe feels like he's back on the pond or something.
It's like one of those like superstitions things for athletes. Like apparently Sergei Bereszin used to always need a half a pack of Lucky Strikes.
That's right. Everybody knows that. He rolled it up in the sleeve of his jersey.
Secret to success.
We haven't. I mean, there's been moments this season where Randy Carlyle's kind of been on the tip of people's tongues. Certainly after that game on Saturday a week ago against the Bruins, where they just looked like they didn't care, like they had no life, and they had a players only meeting after that game. Haven't lost since, albeit it's been two games against maybe a historically bad team in the Buffalo Sabres and a team missing 100 guys yesterday in Columbus. But I think it's going to take, I don't know, a near miracle to save Randy Carlyle's. If Randy Carlyle is the head coach of this team next year, what does that mean happen this year? Did they like win a first round series? Well, how is Mike Babcock not the head coach of this team next season?
I think that's the underlying question everybody has. I think everyone's sort of expecting that. But you know what? If they do go one round, two rounds, then it becomes more of a conversation. But
even if they make the playoffs, it's going to be difficult to fire Randy Carlyle, right? How do you fire a guy who, you know, pretty much lived up to expectations, maybe overachieved slightly? How do you go turn around and can a guy?
Well, if Mike Babcock's available, then
you just do Rick Renteria like the Chicago Cubs and Joe Maddon, and, you know, because a guy's available, you just can the coach?
I can see it. I could see it happening. I mean, I think the question is, you know, if they don't make the playoffs, I think then you're it's more of a reasonable conversation. But I mean, then it, you know, he puts a bit of an argument up after that.
Is there a scenario you see this season where the Leafs make a coaching change in season? Like, is there a bottoming out where, you know, the writing's on the wall and Brandon Shanahan does fire that first bullet of firing the head coach?
Well, there's a lot of speculation that's sort of why you keep Carlisle around, you keep the coach around for a little while, see how things go, and then you've got that, I mean, not a gimme, but you have that first step to say, well, we're making changes. So, I mean, maybe if things start to slip, maybe you're talking like, you know, in the new year, if things are looking like we're not heading towards the playoffs, then maybe you see something, but I don't know. I really don't.
Be interesting to see what happens tonight as they get a pretty good team, I hear, a Chicago Blackhawks team. They're not bad. They're 6-3-1 this season, 13 points in 10 games down to the Air Canada Center on Hockey Night in Canada. When we come back, Gordie Howe, serious stroke, resting at his daughter's house in Texas. Dan is his close personal friend, I guess. I don't know. You're getting texts. You're getting updates. So we're gonna check in on Gordie and maybe talk about the legacy of Mr. Hockey, third most points all time in NHL history. We'll also talk a little bit about those rumors coming out of Vegas about a possible expansion or relocation of a team to the MGM Grand, which would be fun to go check out, you know, yeah. On your guys' trip or your bachelor party down to Vegas, go see a hockey game as well, sure. And maybe just a tour around the NHL as a whole. I'm Ben Ennis. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live with Dan Robson and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Brett Popplewell.
Let's see if you bastards can do 90.
There's a section of salt-covered desert near the Utah-Nevada border where the ground is so flat that you can see the earth curving out of sight on the horizon. They call this the Bonneville Salt Flats, and it's home to the world's fastest speedway. It's a wondrous place that has attracted speed freaks for the past 100 years. They arrive from all corners of the world, dragging homemade rockets behind them. This summer, I followed four Canadians as they set out for the desert, each hoping to set a land speed record in the only place that matters. They were all eccentric in a way that men who refuse to grow old so often are. Like the 65-year-old Vancouver man who'd turned his vintage Triumph into a bullet capable of 320 kilometers per hour. Or the 66-year-old Winnipeg man who'd already set four records on a Harley the same age as he was. Then there was the Nova Scotia grandfather who'd been to hell and back with cancer and found a survivor's heaven out on the salt. They'd all spent long winters in their garages building machines based on visions they'd had in the night. But it was in the desert that I really got to know them. That's where they stood in their leathers, staring off in silence, looking like men trying hard not to think about all the ways they might kill themselves in the next 2 minutes. Then they put on their helmets and took off.
In the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand. This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live in the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Dan Robson, taking you through until noon. And then I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today, noon till 1. Some pretty disturbing, sad sort of news out of National Hockey League. A week ago Sunday, Mr. Hockey, Gordie Howe, suffered a serious stroke. He's resting with his daughter at her home in Texas. Dan, I know you've been kind of keeping pretty close tabs on it because of your connections in the hockey world. Just retweeted your tweet about Mr. Hockey a video of him actually watching a tribute on his iPad. Looked like he's doing okay, actually.
Nice to see after sort of a week of, you know, just kind of everyone worrying and a lot of tributes going out about Gordy, but everyone not really sure what was going to happen with him because we just had sort of, we knew it was a severe stroke. His son Murray put up on his, on YouTube just recently, the video of him watching that tribute. It was a really touching tribute that the Red Wings did the other night. And it was really nice to see him because he's sitting up and he's able to watch it and things seem to be going well. So he looked good in that video.
Yeah, that's good news because anytime you hear serious stroke and you're talking about a guy who's in his late 80s, 86 years old, is Gordie Howe. Not exactly, you know, you get a little concerned, but it was good to see that he was upright. He was looked like he was aware of what was going on. So hopefully a full recovery for Gordie Howe. Are we ever going to see anything like Gordie Howe? I mean, firstly, are we ever going to see anyone in the National Hockey League play with their son on the same team? Like, that's not likely to happen anytime soon, is it, Dan?
I doubt highly that it's, but yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, you don't have a guy that can play quite as long as Gordie Howe did, and that's the thing, his unique level of resilience.
You had Chris Chelios playing pretty deep into his 40s there, but yeah, like 50 years old, like Gordie Howe, I don't know if it's going to happen again.
No, I don't think it's going to happen again, no.
Throwing the elbows out there and then registering the points that he did.
Yeah. Having his elbows hang out that long, being able to survive all the, like, I've saw his elbows when I did a story with him and they're still inflamed. Like,
really?
Yeah. There's it's kind of gross, but there's sort of sacks of fluid around both of them because you just see it. I did the story for the magazine 2 years ago and hung out with him for a couple of days. And in that I saw his massive elbows that are just still wounded from years of wounding other people.
I think anybody that's met Gordie Howe has some sort of Gordie Howe story about how great a guy he was, how accommodating, how nice he was. Do you have one of those stories? I mean, you've actually talked. I've never talked to him, but you've obviously spent some serious time with him.
Yeah, it's honestly one of my. I mean, I talk about it all the time because as a reporter, you often don't become sort of a fan. But I got to go and hang out with him for 2 days for this feature I did for Sportsnet magazine and. It was a special, special experience for me. I mean, we hung out at his son's table doing a puzzle and drinking hot chocolate and chatting about Maurice Richard and, you know, playing for the Red Wings, all this stuff. And then it was a really unique, privileged moment in my life, just being able to have that experience. And like he had his Northwood hockey stick over in the corner. It was his son's house in Ohio and pictures everywhere and books and all this stuff. But he was kind of like a grandfather the way he spoke. He told me all of his stories, and he was just really.
He is hockey's grandfather, isn't he?
He really is, yeah. And that's part of the thing. I think that's one of the reasons why we, this week everyone was so concerned and interested in just knowing what was going on with him, because that's it. I mean, we think about him as a hockey legend, but you know, where we look down, we think about, you know, Gretzky, Lemieux, or I mean, in terms of being the greatest of all time, there are those who make that argument. But that's not really the point with Gordy. Is that Gordy represents an entire era of hockey, and he is like hockey's grandfather. I think like. His book just came out, and you have Wayne Gretzky and Bob Uhr promoting it because he wasn't fully able to do interviews and stuff like that. So you've got these greats that just line up to, you know, praise Gordy, and that's why he has such a special place in the hockey world, and you know, that's why everyone's wishing him well.
Speaking of books, The Crazy Game, memoir of Clint Malarchuk, available at bookstores everywhere, Amazon, you know. All those places you can buy books. Dan Robson authoring that one. That's number three. Checks in the mail. Also, around the National Hockey League, news coming out of Vegas, and it seems like every couple of weeks we get news out of Vegas, and there was some before the season, but a bunch of places going to get NHL teams in 2017. Well, those rumors have kind of resurfaced after MGM announced plans to build a big arena, 20,000-seat arena, at the MGM on Las Vegas Boulevard. And they also confirmed that they were in conversations with somebody about a team. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the NHL, but I don't know who else that would mean. I think it's just a matter of time before Vegas gets some sort of top four major professional league team in that city. And I guess the NHL makes the most sense. I don't know if you can do a baseball. It'd have to be a closed air stadium because it gets so stinking hot there in the summer. And if you've been to Cashman Field, apparently it's just the horrible conditions to see a baseball game, and they don't get a lot of people out to watch the 51s. But I guess hockey kind of it makes a little more sense to have a hockey team in Las Vegas. And I don't know if you get the tourists coming down to Vegas to go watch a hockey game. Does this seem like something that has legs, Dave?
Well, I think so. You know, Vegas is a surprisingly good sports town. When you think of, you know, I was down there for the Summer League, and granted, it's the NBA Summer League, but I mean, they packed them in there, and you can feel there's a sense of like pride for those UNLV teams.
Yeah.
And they do pretty well in terms of following in that city. So I think there's a sports audience there. I don't know how much the Summer League was people wanting to get out of the sun and into air conditioning, you know, but maybe that's a big driver for ticket sales. Who knows? But obviously, you know, you look at the Coyotes as a team that's pretty much for sure going to move.
Yeah.
And when you think of cities that make sense, you know, Quebec City comes to mind, Seattle. But when you have a city or an organization taking the steps to build that arena and show that kind of potential commitment, that's really what makes a difference and what will drive a team to Vegas.
Can't you envision Floyd Mayweather like pressed up against the glass, banging on the glass in the corners, right? Like that's not a big leap to go there and see Floyd Mayweather. Seems to make sense to me.
Also, I want a pro sports team in Vegas just for like all the tabloid type stories, you know.
Oh yeah.
Can you imagine?
Oh, Tyler Seguin needs to be traded immediately to that team in Vegas. We need Carter and Richards out there too. Bunch of guys. Yeah, I think it'd be hilarious.
That'd be a legendary team. Yeah.
Yeah, I think everybody would want to go down there for those preseason games too, right? Yeah. Like you would want it if you're coaches and general managers would probably cringe at every road preseason game in Vegas.
Yeah.
But I think the players would be going nuts.
My concern about Vegas as a place for a professional sports team, though, is that it's such a fluid town. I mean, you mentioned the idea of you come in and you want to gamble and do stuff, and then you're going to go see a team. But is there a base there, enough of a base that are going to support that team? It's outside of the main strip economically. It's not the hot spot in the U.S.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, do casinos go out and gobble up a whole bunch of season tickets and then, you know, give them away as comps to people? I would imagine. It's not like there's a dearth of money in Vegas. There's lots of it around.
But the casinos also want to keep those people at their high rolling tables and not send them all. Go
That's
spend
true.
Some time over there.
Although maybe there is, you know, like a slot machine in the concourse.
Oh, yeah. You can bet there.
Oh, there would be for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And some
it's
blackjack
built
tables.
At a casino.
It could
it's
be a lot
at
of
the
fun.
MGM.
Don't get me wrong, it would be a lot of fun. I would definitely go to Vegas and have a great time there and watch some good hockey.
Yeah, you're going to go to Vegas anyways, though, you degenerate. Dan Robson, Dave Zarum. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. A lot to talk about around the National Hockey League as we're just about a month into this regular season. I don't know if there are big takeaways we can come or any big conclusions we can come to yet, but there's a couple of things that are interesting to see. I guess I was among those that was curious to see how the Montreal Canadiens would respond after making it to the Eastern Conference Finals against the Rangers last year, a very surprising playoff run for them getting through the Bruins, and wondering if there was a carryover in the off season of PK Subban and all the intrigue that happened there and finally getting that 8-year deal done. Well, so far, so good. They're 8-2-1. Carey Price hasn't even played all that well. What is kind of interesting, though, is that, I mean, they are 8-2-1. Their goal differential is zero.
Yeah, so
given up as many goals as they've scored. They were unbeaten at home, though, 4-0. Is it time to start talking about this team, you know, along the lines of the Bruins, who are off to a kind of a mediocre, if not bad, start, and the Penguins as one of the elite teams in the Eastern Conference?
Well, that point you just make, though, I mean, you look at their goal differential being zero, but behind them, Tampa Bay is, you know, they're up 9. I mean, I think there's something to worry about when we look at a team this early in the season and start saying this is a team that's going to be going for it. They're a good team. They're a lot of fun to watch. And I do think of our Canadian teams, they're definitely the best one with the most opportunity. Are they at that level? I don't know yet, though.
I don't know, man. I don't care about their goal differential if they're winning games at the end of the day. I mean, when you look at what they did last season, the big question with teams like that are, you know, is this a fluke? And when you see them kind of continue that success the following year, then I think it's natural to have a lot of confidence in how they're going to perform.
And if there was any concern about PK Subban after signing that big deal, it doesn't seem like there's any drop-off from him. A couple of spectacular goals already this season.
That's such an encouraging sign if you're a Habs fan, right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any doubt about PK Subban at all, though. I mean, he's the face of this league. Like, he's the star of this league. He knows that he wants that role, and he brings so much energy to that club. And you can just see how much with that energy, what he brings to an organization. When you have a guy like that in your team, it's just, there's a lot of intangibles along with the fact that he can also score goals.
But they can't name him the captain, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's just a matter of time, isn't it?
It has to be. I think it's just a matter of, like, next year. Like, I'm actually confused by that, to be honest.
Yeah. It seems like he's the captain in waiting, but as of yet hasn't been given that title.
Skip the ceremony. I mean, give it to him.
I guess his team, it's good for team dynamics. You spread it out a bit and you get and also it's so distinct. People talk about PK Subban all the time when you talk about the Habs. Maybe as an effort to say, this is a team and this isn't just, you know, PK's team. And I think that, you know, they're all able to understand that because they are a team that I think gels really well together. And like I said, they're a lot of fun to watch.
And I guess it shouldn't be wild to say this or crazy to say it. I mean, they were, you know, a win from getting into the Stanley Cup final, and then you're four wins away from winning the thing. But should we be classifying them in that class that could win the Stanley Cup? I think we probably agree that the best teams in the NHL are out west and probably have the best shot of winning the cup. But are they in that top five, maybe, that when you're talking about Stanley Cup contenders, Montreal Canadiens right there?
I mean, I think, sure, why not? I mean, when you look at all the pieces that those kind of championship contending teams need, you need the goalie, you need the reliable point producers, you need the back end guys, you need the leaders. And I mean, I think Montreal has all those things.
And
right,
you
now
need the experience, which they picked up last year.
Yep. Yeah, that's probably the most important one.
You make a good point about, I think there's, I don't know if they're top five. I mean, there's at least four teams in the West, I think, are a better shot than they do, just with you know, how talented they are. But I mean, in the East, they do have, I mean, there are some good teams in the East. They've got Pittsburgh, Detroit, and Tampa are I think quite good, and I really like the way Tampa looks too.
So, are you concerned about Boston? I mean, that back end, first of all, they're without Zdeno Chara, which is a big loss, both literally and figuratively.
Yeah,
because he's a large human. And you lose Johnny Boychuk as well.
Yeah.
Trade him away due to salary cap reasons, and yes, they're off to a 6-6 start to the season.
I don't know. I'm intrigued by Boston. I'm looking to see how they do over the next few months. I mean, without Char, this is a big challenge for them. You have a team that's been so good for a good period of time. Are they at a point now where they're tipping over the edge and need to sort of reboot? That's the question. So I'm interested in Boston. Obviously, they're always there as a threat, but I don't know. I think there's some fresh teams right now that I think have a better shot than they do.
Yeah, Torrey Krug also out for the Boston Bruins. Penguins, we knew they were going to be up there. The Metro is just not that good, though, right? And especially if we think the Rangers have taken a step back this season, who knows? Henrik Lundqvist has kind of been which he was kind of during the regular season last year as well, and then came on in the playoffs. But they add Patrick Hornquist. He's been a nice addition. And Sidney Crosby, as long as he's healthy, we obviously know he's going to be one of the best players in the National Hockey League. But is there something to be said for playing in a division that I think we expect them to lead it wire to wire, right? Are they going to be challenged in the Metro Division? It's all about playoff time for the Pittsburgh Penguins, isn't it?
It really is, and that's the problem. That's been the biggest problem with Pittsburgh, is the playoffs have fallen apart repeatedly for them late. And Marc-Andre Fleury hasn't been reliable in that sense. And you have, I mean, Sidney Crosby clearly has to be frustrated with that situation. But they've made changes, and I think that, you know, playoffs are such a toss. We can look at that team and think about how great they are, and they don't make it. I mean, I don't know. Like, are they? What do you do to make Pittsburgh better, I guess, is the question, when you have, like, those guys on that team?
I don't know. Do they win another cup if they have a better goaltender?
Well, I mean,
you got to give Marc-Andre Fleury credit for winning the one cup they did because of that tremendous save in the dying seconds against the Red Wings, too, right?
Yeah.
You can't forget about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's that's the thing. He does get that, but then the question is he a playoff goaltender in that sense? Because his numbers, I don't know what they are actually right now,
you know, off
the top of my head, but they're not that bad. And he's always a good goalie in the top echelon. But then it's just the thing about goaltending is that you're not the star until you do that consistently in the playoffs and you're playing incredible. So he has that, but in the last few years, he's been a problem.
I think the last season, I think 2-3 years ago, he was really a problem in net for them in the playoffs, and it showed. Exactly. But when you look at last season, I don't point to him as the reason why they lost necessarily. I mean, he did give, I think there's one or two kind of soft goals in that series against the Rangers, but I think the Fleury problem gets a little bit blown out of proportion. When you look at his numbers, there was like two really bad years, and then he's kind of back to somewhat steady now. I mean, it's not amazing, but I don't think he's a problem.
Let's look out west. And people were looking at the Vancouver Canucks as going one of two ways. One, last year was an anomaly. The Twins are never going to produce that poorly again. Or this is kind of a team in need of a complete overhaul. Well, it turns out they're actually not that bad, at least through 10 games. Second in the Pacific Division at 7-3. Go out and get Ryan Miller. Maybe they will, you know, actually hold on to a decent goaltender for once. He's had a pretty good start to the season. And maybe the Vancouver Canucks are one of those teams in a very difficult Western Conference, and people talking about, well, if the Canucks are in the playoffs, who's coming out of that top eight in the West? Well, it looks like the Canucks might be in the playoffs, and somebody might be coming out. Are they a legit threat in the West?
I don't know about threat, but they're definitely looking good so far. I think they look like a playoff team. I think Verbata has been really, really impressive the way he's playing, obviously bringing Miller in. I mean, I like what they're doing so far.
I guess there was more importance on the head coach, Willie Desjardins, come in. You haven't heard a negative word about him. And John Tortorella is somewhere on that island with Ron Wilson somewhere.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's probably a huge part of it as well. The team dynamic and the temperament has got to have changed. I mean, I imagine that they feel better than they did last year, and they've got that off their shoulders now. So
I guess press conferences, media conferences must be just a lot more boring.
Yeah, less entertaining for sure.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah, but
it's funny. We haven't. I can't believe we still haven't heard from Ron Wilson. Honestly, I just bring his name up because I guess he still exists, right? He's like, he's on planet Earth, or is he? You know, maybe he's out finding new planets for us to, you know, live on or something. I feel like he's not on this planet. Like he's not in the solar system because we haven't heard about him in years.
Where is he actually?
I think. Listen, I think I got your next book.
Where is Ron Wilson?
Yeah,
I think that could. Yeah, let's do it.
Speaking of the books, The Crazy Game, Dan Robson, memoir, Clint Malarchuk, available bookstores everywhere. When we come back, gonna look back a couple of days ago. Game 7 of the World Series was about as entertaining as it gets. I mean, you had the tying run 90 feet away in the bottom of the ninth, and you had a historic performance from Madison Bumgarner. Are the San Francisco Giants a dynasty? We'll discuss that. Also, whether they can continue their current run. Three World Series titles in the last 5 years, but you've got some pieces there that might be on the move, including Pablo Sandoval, who is a free agent, and he wants a couple ducats thrown his way. More than a couple. Also, we'll talk about Joe Maddon headed to the Chicago Cubs. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Dave Zarum and Dan Robson on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
The 2-2 pitch and a swing and a ball popped up. This is going to be in play and foul territory for Sandoval, and the Giants have won the World Series again. Madison Bumgarner with a phenomenal performance. 5 shutout innings in relief here tonight.
Dan Shulman with the call on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, Madison Bumgarner is slightly good as the San Francisco Giants win Game 7, 3-2 over the Kansas City Royals. That was on Wednesday. Man, where does the time go? Feels like yesterday. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dan Robson and Dave Zarum. So the Giants win the World Series like we all expected. A team that, you know, was the second wild card team, so barely made the playoffs, and then had to play a one-game play-in to get into the DS. So did the Royals, though, too. And now they have their third World Series title in the last 5 years. They've been kind of lousy in the, like, middle years. They do the even year thing where they win a World Series and they kind of fade off into obscurity in the next year. So I guess they that's a pretty good party going on in San Francisco. So I guess our expectations should be low. The Giants next season, Dave?
History would suggest it. It's kind of like the San Antonio Spurs. They kind of win it every other year, or appear every other year.
You have to bring it back to basketball, don't you?
It's just an apt comparison. No, that was an amazing, amazing, amazing World
Playoffs
Series.
I mean, overall were great, right? Like there was maybe three games that were kind of blowouts early that you didn't really need to watch to the conclusion, but there were a lot of great games.
I always wonder what's going on with the baseball playoffs. They have these huge blowouts all throughout the season, and every baseball playoff game seems like it's decided by like two runs or incredibly close.
And maybe the best game of the bunch was the very first one. Remember the Royals and A's in that game, and the Royals down four runs headed to the eighth inning, come back and win it, and then go down in extra innings and win that game, and then end up in a seventh game of the World Series.
I mean, it really does. It's kind of fluffy, but it really does show you like all you have to do is just get in, and then see what happens.
Well, does that? This is a question I've asked a couple of times on this show, and I'm not 100% sure how I feel about it. It makes it more entertaining, no question, that you have no idea what's going to happen in baseball when it comes to playoff time. And in the regular season, you get those surprising teams too. Whereas the NBA, and Dave, tell me if I'm wrong here, like we know what's going to happen come playoff time already.
We're
two games into the regular season. We know that, you know, okay, maybe there's going to be some surprising team that's half decent, but it's not like the Wizards are going to shock everybody and end up in the NBA final, right?
No, it's true. And you also think of, like, remember when the Warriors beat the Mavs when they had Baron Davis?
Right.
And people still talk about that as this big thing. I feel like that happens every year in baseball. Mm-hmm. And because it happens so often, it's not like stored in history in the same way.
Yeah, hockey can kind of be the same way. You do get those eights over ones, like you're talking about the Warriors over the Mavs in that case, and that was just a weird matchup thing where the Mavs matched up so poorly against the Warriors. Where in baseball, you play the most regular season games of any of the professional sports leagues.
Not even close.
162. You play every day. You get maybe a couple days off a month. You can have an historic regular season like Clayton Kershaw did, and then you have a couple of screw-ups in the postseason, you're done, and your season, he's going to win a Cy Young, probably an MVP. It's going to be defined by the playoff losses, right? Is that fair?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's kind of the fascinating thing about baseball, though. It's just the length of it, and then just to have that fall apart just so quickly, it's devastating. But, I mean, it also makes it really, really interesting for us to watch. Yeah. I mean, it really does make it fun. Like those wild card games, as much as people hate them, they were a lot of fun.
Yeah, and that was, like I said, maybe the most entertaining game of the postseason. Game 7 was amazing. Yeah. Before we go any further, should the Royals have sent Alex Gordon?
Yeah.
In the bottom of the ninth with two out, the ball gets to the wall, it's booted around. Even if he doesn't make it, don't you want to see the World Series wanted to play at the plate? How amazing would that have been?
Exactly. And here's the thing. I mean, he couldn't have expected the guy to
boot it.
To boot it, right? So who knows how hard he was going into first or second. I'm not going to say he wasn't trying hard. Obviously he was at that situation especially. But yeah, for the potential of what could have happened there to just hold him up at third, knowing you're facing a pitcher who is unhittable,
right?
You know, what are the chances it's going to happen two at-bats in a row? Yeah,
that play,
I think you have to go for it there.
That play at home would have become one of the most like iconic, memorable moments in life.
Oh, yeah, easily.
You know, just outer safe, it would have been incredible.
But you know, it's the third base coach. If he sends him home and he gets out and the World Series is over, that's on him forever. So you can see why he'd hold him up, right? I mean,
yeah,
so exciting though. I was just watching.
God, watching that. Yeah, I wanted him to keep going so bad though.
Yeah, I was trying not to wake up my wife at the time, but yes, I was losing my mind there too. But Madison Bumgarner came right back, got the foul pop to end the game, and he's the story of this postseason. Maybe the Chevy guy actually is the story of the postseason.
Oh, no question.
The Chevy guy. People are still talking about the Chevy guy.
I actually
technology
have not
and
seen
stuff.
Also, the Chevy guy because I turned it off. I was at a bar when I didn't see it, and then I started talking about it.
We need to get the audio.
I don't want to watch that. I feel so bad for this guy. Everyone was like talking about him.
Well, wait till you listen to it. It's amazing. But also, I think they recalled that Chevy that they gave to Bumgarner. Like, I'm serious.
Really?
I think so. I think that's one of the Chevys that got recalled.
Because I know Chevy, they had some problems with the airbag. Yeah. So, well, it must be that
a double whammy for Chevy.
That technology and stuff must be tough. you kind of fell for that guy, though, right? Yeah. I mean, this is a big moment. And he had the cue cards knowing that maybe I'm going to need these things, even though I have, like, two sentences to say.
He was so nervous. So
I might be the only person who hasn't watched this yet.
Yeah, it's kind of unbelievable.
We're going to track down the audio. We'll play it for you in a second here. Good. Don't worry about it, Dan. But it was tremendous. So he was the secondary story. Madison Bumgarner was to the Chevy guy. But Bumgarner, unbelievable, right? And the numbers, whatever. They're you rattle them off. They're historic. ERA under 1, 4-1. He had the save in game 7 on 2 days rest. throwing over 50 pitches after throwing 118 the start before 2 days previous. That's, I mean, I don't even know if, I was going to say, is this a, you know, the start of some trend where you try and push your starters a little bit further? I don't know if you can. Like, it seems like Madison Bumgarner's a freak in that sense. I don't know if there's anybody else out there that you can throw that often.
And that's the thing. It's also when you look back historically at how many people have done what he did, and the fact that it's almost nobody. I forget where I heard it, but it was someone was saying, anytime you have to go back in the history books and find your comparison is a guy named Whitey.
Like, yeah, not a lot of Whiteys anymore.
Yeah, that's a sign that what you're doing is rare and special.
Yeah, there's a Whiteys. Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to see a Whitey again.
No,
in Major League Baseball.
It's a bygone generation.
Maybe in all of sports.
Retired.
Yeah. Speaking of historic greatness, Bruce Bochy now is going to be mentioned along the lines of Tony La Russa, as one of those iconic great managers. And everybody, I mean, there was a lot of hype surrounding Joe Maddon. We'll get to him in just a second as maybe the best manager out there in Major League Baseball. I think now people are putting Bruce Bochy on that same level. And along that line, how much of an impact can a manager have? Because again, this is a team that really had no business being in the World Series, let alone winning it. And, you know, you can look at some decisions throughout the playoffs. Look at the Washington Nationals, who a lot of people thought had the most talent of any of the teams in the playoffs in Major League Baseball. And a couple of decisions, Matt Williams maybe keeps Jordan Zimmermann in there for that ninth inning, the game that goes 18 innings where they blew the save in the ninth inning. Maybe if he keeps his starter in there who was cruising, maybe they're in the World Series. Maybe they're winning a World Series. So I think there is something to be said for a manager being a key part of this run for the San Francisco Giants and in the form of Bruce Bochy.
And I think even before they officially won it, you know, people were looking at him and looking at what he's done. Was it three series in the last 5 years?
Yeah.
And that's a really impressive, especially in baseball.
Yeah. The question though, that manages always, it's that question. It's like, well, what exactly was that? And are there moments that, I mean, in watching the postseason, we're like, that was just a brilliant managerial move.
Well, how many guys do you think put Madison Bumgarner out there for 5 innings in a game 7? 5 innings after he just threw 120 pitches 2 days prior.
I think Bumgarner was kind of dictating that with how good he was pitching. Yeah.
Well, he said there was a quote. It was like, you know, he didn't want to take him out, and Bumgarner didn't want to go out.
Exactly.
He said, I'm not tired. And Bumgarner was totally confident. Like, he doesn't believe in, you know, any pitch.
You saw it
you
saw it in his pitch selection. He kept going for those high pitches, getting the guys to chase just relentlessly. Like,
yeah.
So much confidence.
He was on his mark. He was crushing it. And then that is a decision to say, you know, the safe move technically is to take you out right now, but I
go to a bullpen that's actually pretty good too.
Yeah, that's rested and hot. Let's close this out. But they say like, no, this is you're in a special moment here, and he could see that in Bumgarner. I think that it takes having faith in your player like that does take a lot of guts, and it does take a lot of instinct.
Yeah, and we've seen position players take over World Series and series before, but I don't know if I've ever seen a pitcher take over an entire series the way Madison Bumgarner, they don't win that series, even if they have a guy that's, you know, half decent starting those games and in those positions that Madison Bumgarner was in.
Because the difference is we've seen guys come back for that third game, but usually, I mean, I think Randy Johnson maybe, but it's just for like an inning in the ninth or something like that. It's not essentially another start, you know, and that's what's so impressive.
The list is very rare for guys to pick up two wins and then pitch more than two innings in a third game in a series. And Madison Bumgarner's on there, I think, with maybe two other guys who pitched 100 years ago.
Exactly.
So,
I think Koufax was one of them. I remember reading that. It was like...
And I think a guy by the name of Cy Young was up there as well.
Christian Matheson. You're going back a long way. And he joined elite company there for sure.
Dan, we have some good news for you. We've tracked down Chevy guys.
Yes.
So if you're not wearing headphones. We'll listen to Chevy guy here.
Madison, congratulations. As the official sponsor or the official vehicle of Major League Baseball, Chevrolet is proud to participate in this prestigious award. Along with our dealers, we are also extremely honored to give back to this sport by supporting baseball in cities and towns across this nation. At Chevrolet, we have also been proud of the latest and greatest technology in our truck lineup, which is the all-new 2015 Chevy Colorado. It combines class winning and leading, technology and stuff with Wi-Fi powered by OnStar, sitting there on screen, to recognize your performance in this 2014 World Series. I proudly present to you very own set of keys to a brand new 2015 Chevy Colorado. Congratulations.
Congratulations to you, Chevy guy. That was...
Congratulations for making Bud Selig look like Michael Buffer.
Yeah.
I like him. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I thought it was a very...
amazing.
It's a human moment, right?
Oh, totally.
And I mean, I think anybody that's like watching it would be like, oh, that's so funny. But like, how nervous would you be? I would be nervous.
I think it was genuinely endearing, you know? Yeah. I don't think people are criticizing him for it.
No, and certainly not people at Chevy who, there are reports that, you know, the eyeballs they would have gotten if he had spoken the words correctly, and we're not talking about him, is, you know, maybe worth $1 million, but that we're talking about Chevy guy, hashtag Chevy guy.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at a $3 million imprint on people's minds.
Also, a viral campaign. They've got to plan this.
I think I heard like Chevy, like the official Chevy Twitter account or whatever, they were tweeting stuff with hashtag technology and stuff. Like they're fully embracing it.
Glad they're embracing
it. If that guy was...
this is going to save the company.
If that was a viral marketing campaign, that guy's the greatest actor of all time. There's no way. I don't know how you fake sweat, man. Like, how do you do... Yeah, I know how there's some great actors that can, you know, cry Chris on command. Farley. How do you sweat on command? Well done, Chevy
Chris
guy.
Chris Farley.
Pablo Sandoval, you know, it speaks to how great Madison Bumgarner was in that series and winning the World Series MVP that we weren't even talking about Pablo Sandoval or Hunter Pence, who had great series. Mm-hmm. They really did. And great game sevens as well. Pablo Sandoval, third baseman for the Giants, now a free agent. And before the playoffs started, there was rumors that the Blue Jays were interested in picking up Sandoval to be their third baseman for next season, moving Brett Laurie to second base. I think they just got priced out of the Pablo Sandoval market. Now, there are reports that he wants $100 million. I want $100 million, right? So it's okay to set your sights high. And if you look at the regular season numbers, they don't jump off the page at you this season. He was just okay. But again, playing in a very pitcher-friendly ballpark, is there somebody that's going to pay Pablo Sandoval his $100 million, his $20 million a year for 5 years? And is that person not in San Francisco?
I can't imagine he garners something in the ballpark of $20 million a year. Maybe close to that. But if I'm San Francisco, I am doing everything I can to bring him back because I do think he was a big part of that team, obviously on the field, but also in terms of the clubhouse and chemistry and things like that, which does matter to a degree.
And he had four RBIs in that win against Kansas. Like he's the guy that we talked about, Bumgarner, who obviously was the MVP, but he was easily the second most important player on that team.
And he is a former World Series MVP well. So he's got the postseason pedigree.
Yeah.
Should a team like the Washington Nationals, who have had their struggles come postseason, look at a guy like that who, you know, during the regular season, he's going to provide some offensive output, but his postseason pedigree is what you're picking him up for. Should they be looking at him?
Yeah, but I mean, don't they pay Zimmerman?
But it looks like his days at third base are numbered because he's had some shoulder problems. But, I mean, there's something to be said. For whatever reason, there's some guys that when the lights turn bright in the postseason, they just turn it on. And, okay, everybody looks at Derek Jeter. That's an easy one because he's played so many games in the postseason. But there are guys like Alex Rodriguez who I know he won his one World Series, but for the length and breadth of his career, he's been a guy who perennially – comes playoff time, he just hasn't performed. And for some reason, whatever it is, Pablo Sandoval, whether the ball's thrown at his eyeballs, he can still put it into left field.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting what you're saying with Washington, because when you were just talking about them before, how maybe they should have been the team that we saw in the World Series just based on talent alone, experience does make a huge difference. Guys like Sandoval, Pence, who've been there before. If you're a team in, let's say, Washington's position where you're kind of right on the cusp there, those are the kind of guys that you need to get, are the guys who've been there and won before.
Big stars coming out of the World Series. Bumgarner's number one. I feel like Hunter Pence might be number two with the bug eyes and the big hair and the wild swing and the wild throwing motion. Gives hope to everybody who's, or every kid that's playing Little League baseball, like throws like a girl or something, you know, who looks just awkward and gangly. Like, there's no way Hunter Pence, by any measure of scouting, should be a professional baseball player, let alone an all-star.
Yeah, I mean, as long as those kids grow to be like 6'4", 6'5", like he is, you know, that's a big factor. That's I don't know if he's that tall, but I've interviewed him before. He's pretty big.
Yeah, tall. And seems like a fun guy. As well. When we come back, the Raptors off to a pretty solid start to their season after one game. They are 1-0. They're in Orlando tonight doing their little tour of Florida because they've got the Heat tomorrow night. So Orlando tonight on Sportsnet. 1-0 after a win against the Atlanta Hawks on Wednesday. And a Hawks team that maybe we shouldn't sleep on. So maybe that'll be a good win when it's all said and done after 82 games. Talk about the Raptors a little bit. And what's going on with the Oklahoma City Thunder? They lose Russell Westbrook, already without Kevin Durant. Can they hold the fort until those guys get back in the Western Conference? Lots to talk about on the NBA front. Maybe we'll touch on a little NFL as well. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis, along with Dave Zarum, Dan Robson, on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine. Here's Arden Zwelling.
Throughout his entire career, from playing junior in Quebec to being a goalie in Canada's most tortured hockey-mad market, Jonathan Bernier has been chasing just one thing, to be a number one.
I don't like to be on the bench. I don't like to be that guy that no one talks about or whatever. To me, it's always been be a number one and be the best in the league every year.
It's why he left Los Angeles and why he came here to Toronto, where he finally got the opportunity to prove himself as a starting goaltender last season. He kept the Maple Leafs in a playoff position almost single-handedly before succumbing to injury late in the year and watching from the press box as his team collapsed in dramatic fashion without him. This year he's back, healthy and ready to reclaim the job he felt here in last season. And now he has a new goal.
To me, obviously this year I know it's a big year, not because it's my contract year. And to me, it's just because I want to bring this team in the playoff. And that's my only challenge where, you know, I want to be consistent every night and I want to bring this team and have a good run in the playoffs.
This is the story of the man with the most pressure-packed job in Toronto, playing net for the Maple Leafs.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple newsstand. Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Dan Robson and Dave Zarum. Raptors back in action. Game two of their season tonight in Orlando against the Magic in a game you can watch on Sportsnet. Opened up the season with a 109-102 win over the Hawks on Wednesday. They were pumped up even before this thing started. Outside in Maple Leaf Square, Jurassic Park, Drake was getting everybody hyped. And then before the game, Kyle Lowry couldn't even speak because he was being drowned up from by the cheers. And they did not disappoint, picking up a win over a Hawks team that took the Pacers to seven games in the opening round of the playoffs last season. Takeaways, all five starters in double digits. The bench was good. Patrick Patterson, Greaves Vasquez also in double figures off the bench. Not exactly great scoring performances by either Kyle Lowry or DeMar DeRozan, as Lowry ended up with 11 points, 15 for DeMar on 4 of 16 shooting. But the big man did the job. Valanciunas, 17 points, a big day at the stripe, 9 of 10, after not getting a foul call called against the Hawks in that opening quarter, which was impressive to see. It's not very often you see a team go an entire quarter. Man, they played that first quarter clean. But afterwards, Raptors did go to the line. So overall, pretty good start, I guess, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, especially because I think that Atlanta Hawks team is a really good team. I think they're going to make a lot of noise in the East this year. And with the exception of the last few minutes there, the Raptors seem pretty firmly in control.
Is that a concern? Because I did tweet that out, actually, at the end of that game where it looked like there should be no stress involved in the final minutes. And we did see it a couple of times last year and in the playoffs, you know, some missed free throws by a guy who's not on this team anymore, John Salmons, cost him a game. There are moments late in games where they're still finding their way, whether that's closing out wins or crossing or jumping over that final hurdle to come back and complete a comeback late in games. Is that just a team learning how to do that? Are there underlying concerning aspects to that?
Yeah, I mean, one game, I'm not going to say it's a huge concern, but you do mention the examples from the past. It's an interesting conversation, I suppose. You look at like championship teams, like the Spurs, for example, and they seem like the kind of teams who don't get in those positions for the most part late in games. When they need to close it out, they do. So you'd like to see the Raptors bridge that gap if they're going to really make noise in the East. But also, I think you give some credit to Atlanta. They're really good at getting those 3-point looks with the way they move the ball. And their system, and they just kind of turned it up at the end there.
They hit 59% from beyond the arc, the Hawks did in that game.
Like, the troubling part of that, again, their offense is set up so that they can get their guys open looks, and they have a lot of guys who can shoot threes, a lot of big men, too, who shoot threes on that team. But, yeah, you know that Atlanta is a 3-point shooting team. They're the attempted more threes than any other team in the East last season. So the fact that they come out and that's their big advantage, you would have hoped that was, like, the number one point of emphasis on the Raptors side defensively.
Kyle Korver, that thing, it's like a layup for him. He was 6 of 7 from three on Wednesday, which is kind of fun. One thing I wondered about headed into this season, and something that I thought the Raptors could do to better themselves, is give the ball to the big man a little bit more, specifically Jonas Valanciunas. Mm-hmm. Now, we saw it a little bit in the postseason. I think game one, he got a whole bunch of looks early in that game against the Nets. Now he only played 21 minutes on Wednesday, got in a little foul trouble, a couple fouls in the first quarter, put him on the bench, but only he had five, field goal attempts. But, like I mentioned, got to the line a whole bunch, 10 times and made 9 of those free throws.
And I think he was 4 or 5,
He was 4 or 5 from the field and 9 of 10 from, the stripe only, and then had 8 rebounds. And I mentioned in very limited time, 21 minutes. In the small sample size we have, Dave, is this look like a team that, and Dwayne Casey maybe preaching this a little bit more as the preseason went along, to get the ball into the big men, both Jonas Valanciunas and Amir Johnson?
Well, I think just in general, I mean, good things happen when you have a guy you can dump it down low to, especially early in possessions. And Valanciunas is that kind of guy. We see it in international competition all the time, right? On the Raptors, though, I mean, the team is set up so that their points are coming from the backcourt, and then the big guys crash the boards and get those kind of garbage buckets. I think you mentioned that New Jersey playoff series where they were getting into Valanciunas early in games. And I think that's kind of where you can use him best, is to kind of start off like that, have this other dynamic, this guy inside doing it inside, which creates space for the guys on the perimeter, right? And then it changes the way the defense has to play throughout the rest of the game. It's just a matter of whether those guys get the ball back to Valanciunas later on in the game as it goes on. So I think you're going to keep seeing him get a lot of touches early on. Tonight, it's a really interesting matchup versus Vucevic on the Magic. So I think they're going to try to really exploit that. He's really gifted offensively. He's got moves, so you want to see him utilize more in that way. But really, I think he's just as effective as a guy being asked to go in and crash the boards and get those kind of clean up garbage points.
Yeah, and anytime you can get the line 10 times, I think the Raptors would take that a whole bunch. Mentioned that fans were going nuts even before this game even started. During the game, we saw it in the postseason. I think there was a lot of people in the North American basketball media that were kind of alerted to the fact that Toronto and the Air Canada Center should be and is a difficult place for the opposition to play. And the NBA, maybe more than any other sport, football, I guess, home field makes the most difference. But if the Raptors can continue where they left off in the postseason as far as the raucous atmosphere and just a difficulty in opposing teams coming in and winning, I mean, that's a huge advantage, Dan.
Yeah, that's what was I found to be so interesting about the opener. I was just like, the energy they had, it felt like it was that what they left off with last year. There was so much excitement last year in the playoffs, and when you saw that energy for the opener, like outside and in that stadium, the excitement is important, and it gets that team excited about being in Toronto. And this is one of the first times we're really, really seeing that. We've had some moments in the past, but this is like, it's fun to watch the Raptors, and Toronto is really getting behind them in that sense, and that's great for this team.
Are we finally finding a crowd that will be proactive in their cheering? Like, in this city, it's a lot of reacting, right? Good things happen. Yeah, we'll applaud. Mm-hmm. We'll get loud. But I think in the NBA, when runs start to happen is when the crowd kind of almost anticipates it. And I feel like that Raptors crowd is turning into that.
Yeah, I think in basketball, like to your point about the importance of a crowd, it's such an intimate experience. I mean, you're courtside. You're right by the players.
There's no boards.
You feel like you're there.
Maybe you are. You're courtside. I'm courtside.
Dave might be courtside when he's watching. But when you're there, you're part of that experience. In hockey, there's boards, there's masks. You're a little bit separated from it. I think that you really feel the energy in a way you might not feel in other sports. And I don't think you're going to see Raptors fans, if they go on a bit of a tank, you're going to see someone throw a Raptors a DeRozan jersey on the court. I'm not saying that Leaf fans, you know, shouldn't do it. Obviously a little bit early and stuff like that. But I mean, I think there's a different kind of fan that's going to these games.
Yeah. And also you think of like when guys, because the crowd is so close, a guy does a dunk, momentum carries him off towards out of bounds and he high fives a couple fans and then runs back on defense. You know, you don't get that kind of stuff in a lot of other sports. I guess the Lambeau League
interaction
is football example.
You know, and we talk a lot about how Leaf fans, oh, they're so quiet and it's because nobody can afford Leaf tickets. Well, you know, Raptors tickets aren't exactly like $5, yeah. Right? Like this is, we should be kind of talking about the same thing because I bet you if you look at ticket prices, they're not that different, Maple Leafs and Raptors tickets right now.
I think with the Raptors fans, it's just a team with a ton of good vibes around it. I don't know how else to say it. Like everyone's just like festive almost about this team right now, based on what happened towards the end of last season. So if the Raptors start losing a ton of games, it's interesting to see what will happen then. But right now, as long as they're successful, you know, it is a bandwagon city for the most part. I think that's explains a big chunk of kind of the support around the Raptors. It's a winning team, so people come out and show up. Last season, the crowds got more and more full as the season progressed. You know, it didn't start that way. It was only until it looked like, yeah, this is a good team, it's going to be in the playoffs, that the crowds really showed up consistently. So I think it's something to monitor. I don't know.
And that's maybe a forgotten thing. The Raptors got off to a lousy start to the season last year, and it looked like they were in full tank mode, trading away Rudy Gay. That's when things completely flipped around, and a horrible Eastern Conference was a big part of it. It's not nearly as horrible this year, especially if Derrick Rose is healthy, and we'll get to some of the other stories around the NBA in just a second. But I kind of that opener kind of reminded me of the Blue Jays home opener a couple years ago when there was so much hype in the offseason.
After all those moves,
and they packed the building. It was so exciting, and everybody was jacked up to see the Blue Jays play and get off to a great start. And they right out of the gate were horrible, never able to recover, and the fans turned sour, and you never got that feeling again. I know it's just one game, and it could just be a couple of games, but to get a couple of wins under your belt after the expectations of an offseason could be huge for this team.
Because I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, where the Raptors stand in the sports market in Toronto. They have a ton of more fan support around them than ever before, especially in comparison to the other teams, right? But what I think is important is the fact that it really does come down to a winning team. You know, that's the big difference maker. This team starts losing, I'm interested if all those fans are still showing up to watch the games outside, you know?
Yeah, especially if it's lousy like today. Luckily, it's not a home game today. I'm sure they're going to pack whatever magic square in Orlando tonight for tonight's game, Magic and Raptors in Orlando, a game you can watch on Sportsnet. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dan Robson and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network. So we're a couple of games in. Most teams have played two games. Raptors have only played one. But it seems like I mentioned how lousy the Eastern Conference was last year. It was just lousy. It was horrible, which makes it even more embarrassing. The Knicks missed the playoffs. But this year it's better, I would imagine. Derrick Rose was healthy, at least for a second there. Left yesterday's game with apparently a high ankle sprain. But it seems like the Bulls are going to be a force to be reckoned with. We all expected Cavaliers to enter that echelon, although they lost their opener to a Knicks team that we're not sure how good they are. The East as a whole, though, it's got to be miles better than it was last year, Dave.
I think you can look at every team and say that they did something to get better. You know, just going back to that Cavs-Knicks thing, I think last season, the season opener, the Heat lost to the Sixers, right? And the Sixers went on to win like 14 more games the rest of the year. So, you know, you have to take that with a grain of salt. But yeah, you look around the East in general, I think you're around the NBA for the most part. Like every team seems like they addressed a need and added something to get better. So it's going to be more competitive. It's going to be a lot more fun to watch Eastern Conference basketball this season. No question.
But doesn't that make it a little more difficult? People have penciled the Raptors in for one of those top four slots. Are we kind of, you know, putting the cart before the horse in that regard? Because there are teams, and they're, you know, the Knicks did knock off the Cavaliers in game one, who bounced back with an overtime win against the Bulls. Well, I guess maybe, how good are the Knicks, Dave, in your opinion?
I think
you picked them to be in the playoffs, didn't you?
I had them at like 8 or 7 to be in the playoffs, it's true.
Didn't look good after game one.
Well, I think, okay, first of all, with Carmelo Anthony, it's such a X factor. I don't want to say X factor, it's so overused, but it's such like a dynamic that 99% of the other teams in the NBA don't have. To have this one guy, we saw it on Thursday night against Cleveland, where I believe the Knicks were up 2. There was like 30 seconds left, and the Knicks were on offense. Cleveland had to get a stop if they wanted to get back in the game. Shot clock winding down. They get it to Melo on the wing. LeBron is playing him. LeBron plays perfect defense, and Melo just puts the shot up over him anyways. Yeah. And there's so few guys who can do that, and it sealed the game for them. It sealed the win for them. And that's just something that a lot of teams don't have, that guy they can just get it to and know good things are going to come from it. I know Melo had a streak where he wasn't hitting those kind of game-clinching shots, but that he's made a career out of that. So I look at his presence. I think they have some young guys who can surprise people, like Tim Hardaway Jr., who knows. I just think everyone's completely writing them off, and I don't think they're that bad. I think the Nets are a lot worse.
There you go. There's a ringing endorsement. They're not that bad, the New York Knicks. And they are 1-1 to start the season. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Let's go out west where, it's just, we talk about the East being a little better than last year. Okay, that's one thing. It's still miles inferior to the Western Conference, where the best teams in the NBA lie.
Yes.
Maybe the best, though, is in Cleveland. We're not sure. It's still waiting to see exactly what they are. And I hearken back to that first year, the Big Three in Miami. They got off to a bit of a rough start, ended up in an NBA Finals, and losing it to the Dallas Mavericks. So maybe we're going to see something similar in Cleveland. But out west, yes, the best teams in the NBA live. But maybe not in Oklahoma City, at least not for the next month and a half. Kevin Durant already out with a foot ailment. Russell Westbrook is now out. He has a broken hand. About 6 weeks, he's going to be gone. It's one thing to have one of your two best guys be out. And we're not talking about, you know, good guys. We're talking about maybe top five players in the NBA, both of them. Yeah. You have them on your team. Now you don't. Yeah. And to try and hold down the fort for the next couple of months is going to be very, very difficult.
Yeah, and that's going to be one of the interesting things when they get back, how... And if they do get back and they're healthy, I mean, that's the other big question mark around it as well. But how are they going to come back from this, you know, from being behind so long? Because they're not going to put up a lot of wins without those two.
Well, do you think, okay, let me preface it like this. I think, you know, you mentioned Westbrook, Durant. When you look at the rest of their depth chart, Reggie Jackson, who's like their third scoring option, he's out. Anthony Morrow, who's brought in to be a big scoring option, he's out. Jeremy Lamb, their shooting guard, he's out. So I think their first five or six offensive options are all injured. So the team we're looking at right now is just a mess. I don't know how they're going to win games or compete. I think Perry Jones had 32 points in the last game. That's not going to happen very often.
Perry Mason?
No.
Oh, okay.
That would be a lot cooler. But so my question is, let's say you look at the roster. I mean, it looks like they're just going to be competing with the Lakers for... Until those guys come back. But when Westbrook and Durant come back, are those two guys good enough to take a team from the basement back to the top of the conference in... 2 months fewer than
and it's
before.
I think it's going to be difficult because it's you can't make the playoffs at 500 in in the West. And again, there's still plenty of time. I think they're going to be in the playoffs, depending if they can come back to full and 100%, which is in the case of Kevin Durant, maybe not 100% because that foot injury, apparently the type that he has, it can be troublesome at times, and the 6 week time frame is kind of movable depending on how he recovers. It's going to be interesting because we've seen them survive with one of those guys out. You know, they've had to do it so often because of the star-crossed nature of that franchise. They've had to go into playoff series without Westbrook. They've had to survive without Durant, and I think one of those guys can take on more of the scoring load when one of them's missing. But when both of them are missing, you're talking about a team that's going to be in the lottery. Now, it's you're just talking about mid-December. There's still plenty of season left to go, but...
I mean, you just have to get them into the playoffs, though, because that's the kind of team, too, that is so talented with those two guys that if they can just get there and get to... I mean, they're going to end up playing a really good team in the West, but, I mean, but they're used to playing.
There is no team in sports that relies on their two big stars like the Thunder do with Westbrook and Durant. So to lose those guys is such a blow to them, more so than almost any other team, because they're so thin after that.
And is the West better? We talked about the East being better, but are the best teams in the West better as well? I mean, Phoenix has really come out of the chute and been good. Denver. I mean, New Orleans. Is New Orleans a team we should be talking about with Anthony Davis?
I think they're going to surprise a lot of people mostly because of Anthony Davis, but they've got good players around him too, and him combined with Omer Asik, who they got from the Rockets this summer, and that's a formidable duo in your front court. And I mean, Anthony Davis looks like he's like the next great NBA star. He's getting like a sleeper MVP candidate, and he might be enough single-handedly to bring a team into the postseason.
Again, we're talking about a couple of games, and we're talking about just a couple of months that these guys are going to be out. But if we're looking at another season gone by where the Thunder do not win an NBA title with those two guys, with the looming free agency, now it's not next year, it's in a couple of years for Kevin Durant, but it's a topic of conversation whenever you bring up the Thunder, whenever you bring up Durant, and especially whenever you bring up Drake and the comments made and the tampering and the allusion to the fact that Kevin Durant grew up a Raptors fan and will be a free agent in a couple of years. If they go through another season without winning a title, a team with title aspirations every single year, now they've gone deep, they've made... they've made deep playoff runs. If they go another year without that, are we going to be looking at a Phoenix Suns scenario, the 8 seconds or less Steve Nash version of the Suns, Dave?
In terms of like an all-time what if?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. We might already be looking at them like that because of how close they've gotten to this point. Because it's rare when you have two guys that good. You know, that really doesn't happen often. And so to have... Durant and Westbrook, and I think people kind of sleep on just how good Westbrook is because Durant is this all generation player. To look at that team and say they haven't won a title, I guess they went to the finals once, but the fact that we might be looking at them next year, even 2 years from now, and saying they never won it, and then that might lead to them being split up, etc. Yeah, this is going to be an all-time woulda, coulda, shoulda.
What do you think it means for Durant? Like, what do you think he's going to be doing?
Well, if I'm Durant, I'm kind of pissed off. I mean, he's like a really loyal guy. That's been his MO for a long time. But they haven't given him a lot of support. Westbrook's a guy who is so talented, but there's a lot of possessions where he's shooting. He's taking shots that should be Durant. So,
right.
I don't know. I could see it going either way.
Before we go, got to get our Schadenfreude in. The Lakers stink. But Kobe Bryant is back, which is good. And this is, to me, it's all mixing itself in this cauldron. And what we might have, now that Julius Randle is now out for the season with the broken leg as well, what we might have is that same scenario that allowed Kobe Bryant to score 81 points against the Toronto Raptors.
It's a similar Lakers team.
Right? Couldn't we have 82 points from Kobe Bryant this year, and then he retires at the end of the season? How great would that be? Nope. Actually, he's not going to retire because he's got a couple of years left on that deal, right?
He's not going to retire because they're going to pay him $25 million next year.
Yeah, so that's not likely to happen. But for a team that's going to lose a whole lot more than they're going to win, there's still some intrigue on that Lakers team, isn't there?
And we're two games in, and you can already see it where Kobe's thinking, like, you know, like, screw this. I'm just going to get my shots.
Where's Smush Parker, right? Parker on this team.
No one motivates Kobe to be selfish more than Smush Parker.
And, so far it looks like the Lakers are going to have their issues after losing all three of their games this season. And, yes, the transition is officially complete. The Clippers are the number one team in L.A., Hey, gents, thanks a lot for this. It's been great.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Oh, once again, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the crazy game, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond, the Clint Malarchuk story written by Dan Robson. You can pick it up. Bookstores everywhere, Amazon, and it's an impressive-looking book. And pictures. There are glossy, full-color pictures. I'll be sure to read and I'll give you a book report coming up probably next week. Thanks a lot, gents. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarem, Dan Robson on the Sportsnet Radio Network.